and thank you to the organizers. It's been really great, a very, very stimulating workshop. Actually, I feel that compared to the discussions we had yesterday in the pub about reality, language, consciousness, this is going to be just a mundane talk. In any case, it is I hope it will be of some interest, since part of the motivation for investigating these questions come from the general aspiration that Lucien put at the beginning of this conference. And so, yes, in this talk, I will discuss a question, which is whether something that we call indefinite causal structures actually exists within the standard quantum mechanics. I will try to argue that, yes, it does, in a precise sense that I will try to describe. So it's really a relatively small technical observation, but I understand that not everyone in the audience is familiar at all with the concept of indefinite causal structures, higher order processes, etc. So I will have to give an introduction to this. So it cannot be very detailed, but I would like to just go through an overview of the main ideas that motivate these questions. Well, this is a talk based on a paper that is now on the archive. So we can make the following observation regarding the standard formulation of quantum theory. As you know, the way it is normally formulated presumes a notion of time, and it's described as a sequence of operations, unitaries, if you believe in measurements, or more general quantum instruments. In the circuit approach to operational probabilistic theories, which allows us one very beautiful way of formalizing the structure of quantum theory, we can speak about circuits. And these circuits, they have a partial order structure, which is implicitly assumed to correspond to the causal structure in space-time, maybe. And so a natural question is whether this assumption about the existence of a definite temporal or causal order between operations in quantum theory is really a representation of some necessity, whether it's a necessity of nature, so to say, whether it reflects some physical property that we must respect, or could it be that the time and causal order of operations could be indefinite. We just have not found the right way to think about it and to see it in this way. And one of the motivations for this, as I mentioned, comes from from the project of searching for a possible extension of quantum theory, which might be compatible with gravity and the way we imagine quantum gravity might be like. So I will describe the process matrix framework, which we introduced as a framework to investigate such questions. And I will link it later to the concept of higher order operations, which was introduced by Kiribella, Dariano, and Perinotti, as I will speak specifically about one operation that they proposed, the quantum switch. But the concept of indefinite causal order, which we call causal non-separability, has been formulated until now only within the framework of process matrices, and there should exist a generalization to higher order processes, but it's not been developed, so this is the reason why I will speak in the language of process matrices. And the idea about the process matrix framework was essentially this idea that we would like to ask whether it is possible to relax the assumption of global causal order, but nevertheless respect quantum theory locally. So the framework proposed to reason about such a possibility is just conceives local experiments that we may associate with Alice, Bob, Charlie, etc., and each is defined with an input and an output system. So essentially, the most elementary notion of operation that we can envision, where basically, you can imagine that some device is used that the agent can choose to apply an operation, maybe a measurement, maybe something else that generally may transform the system, and a new system is sent out of the lab. But we don't want to assume a prior notion of causal structure. But what we assume is that it would make sense to speak about joint probabilities. And I mean, this is a general framework that one may reason about correlations. However, the quantum process matrix is concerned with a particular instance of this, where we make further strong assumptions about how these local experiments are described. And basically, what we assume is that these are quantum systems, so there will be a Hilbert space associated with the input system, another Hilbert space associated with the output. So I label the inputs by one, the outputs by two for this talk. And well, the most general operation that you can do inside is a quantum instrument. So it's a collection of CP maps from the space of operators over the input Hilbert space to the space of operators over the output Hilbert space. And so I will just very quickly mention the two main assumptions that we make in order to derive the formalism. The first one is that the joint probabilities will be just functions of the CP maps associated for the outcomes. So given a choice of setting, when we look at the probabilities for the outcomes of these operations, there will be just functions of the CP maps. So the CP maps are essentially equivalence classes of events in the circuit approach to quantum theory. And here the assumption is that they are still the equivalence classes in this generalized setting. And if you assume that the certain rules of quantum theory hold locally, you can argue for linearity. Or if you like, you may just assume that the probabilities are linear functions. That doesn't matter. So this is the first assumption, which suggests a simple representation of these probabilities. The representation that we use is based on the Choi isomorphism, which associates with every CP map a positive semi-definite operator on the tensor product of the input and output Hilbert spaces. I should say that, well, there are various versions of this isomorphism, but I would like to advertise one which I think is of particular interest because it has a physical interpretation related to time reversal, which we developed here. For in any case, for the purposes of this talk, you may just regard this as a convenient representation. But I think that there is more that one can see in relation to the Choi isomorphism from a particular perspective. So if we represent the local CP maps by positive semi-definite operators, linearity means that, well, we can write a formula of this kind, which looks very much like Born rule. So the joint probabilities will be given by such a linear expression. Well, but in contrast to Born rule, it can describe signaling because these are CP maps. They are not just POVM elements, so they don't sum up to the identity always, and this allows for signaling. And there is another assumption that we make, and that is that these local operations can be extended to act on arbitrary quantum states, and this implies that actually, if you want your probabilities to be valid probabilities, so numbers which are between 0 and 1, then the process matrix should be a positive semi-definite operator. And on top of that, you have normalization. So for every deterministic operation that you do locally, you should the probability should be 1. So this means that for all CPTP maps that you can plug in here, this should be 1. And this gives rise to a set of conditions on the process matrices. So not every positive operator is a valid process matrix, but it turns out that it is there exists a nice classification of the valid process matrices in terms of operators in a Hilbert-Schmidt basis. I will not go through this. I'm just telling you that despite the fact that it sounds horrible to demand this normalization, actually, in a suitable choice of basis for operators, you can easily verify whether an operator is a process matrix or not. So another way of viewing process matrices is as higher order operations. This was a concept introduced by the Pavia group. You may think of it this way, essentially. So here, this is like a circuit-like language where you compose operations to form something like a circuit, maybe. Circuits, they assume definite ordering between operations. Here you can see that this is in general like a cyclic circuit because you cannot have a partial order between the wires in general. So you can see it this way. You demand that this is an operation which takes as an input two operations which could be extended to act on auxiliary systems. You require that whenever you put in here trace preserving operations or channels, the result would be a channel. So this is another way of defining what a process matrix is. And there are, let me just give a few examples. Well, okay, a process matrix which describes such a situation for two parties. You have, let's say, a joint quantum state is prepared and sent into the inputs of the two laboratories, and then the states are traced out. It's just described in this very intuitive form. You just have the density matrix on the input, and then you have identity on the output, which is related to the fact that you trace out. Here's another example. A state is with density matrix rho is fed into the input of Bob. Then there is a channel C from Bob to Alice. Here is the Choi operator of the channel. There is a transposition here. This is how it's represented. Interestingly, most generally, if you assume that only one party can signal to the other, which is the case for all scenarios in which a fixed causal relation between the parties exists, actually, it can be realized. If you just demand the signaling constraint, it turns out that it has a realization not only within the process framework, of course, but also physically as a circuit with memory. Essentially, you just prepare a joint system. You send into the input of Alice, let's say, one part, and then her output goes together with the rest through some channel to Bob. And this is actually the most general scenario that is compatible with one party signaling to the other at most. I find it remarkable that it actually has a realization, physical realization. We may, of course, consider more general scenarios, like because this is a natural, it's a convex formalism, we may form probabilistic mixtures. So, for example, you may conceive of scenarios in which Alice is before Bob with some probability, or Bob is before Alice with some other probability, in which case the process matrix would be given something like this. And this is what we call a causally separable process matrix for the bipartite case. And as it turns out, this formalism actually contains more general things than just these things that we can imagine realizing with just randomness and definite causal order between the parties. I'll just review for those who've never heard about this, about the way we showed in our first paper. It is through a very radical example, in fact, because it gives rise to correlations that can witness this lack of definite causal order in a device-independent fashion, something similar to a Bell inequality. So consider a game where Bob is given two bits, B and B prime, and Alice is given a bit A, which is random. These are random and uncorrelated bits. And we look at the following task. We try to maximize this probability, which can be interpreted as follows. If B prime happens to be zero, the goal is that Bob communicates the bit B to Alice. So we look at whether the output bit she produces, X, is equal to B that was given to Bob. Or otherwise, if B prime happens to be one, we look at whether Y is equal to A. And so it's easy to see that actually causal order imposes constraints. One can prove this inequality. It's very intuitive since there is one of the two causal orders. And if B prime is independent of this, which particular causal order is realized, or they may be as well space-like separated, but space-like separation can be seen as falling within one of the two cases. Well, in that case, let's say that Alice is in the past. This means that Bob could not communicate the bit B to her, which means that she can, her guess will be uncorrelated from Bob's bit B. So this would be equal to 1/2. The other thing could be up to 1 in principle. So this is how you obtain 3/4. And probabilistic mixtures cannot help you beat this bound. So this is how you can prove. And it turns out that actually we gave an example that you can actually violate these causal inequalities. Like there is some strategy. I will not go through the details. There is a particular example that we came up with and show that this is possible. And actually a lot is now understood about causal inequalities. There's been a lot of work about it. I will not discuss much, but now we understand similarity between this and Bell inequalities. and so forth. The natural question that arises from this is whether these things actually have a physical realization. And by that I mean within the non-quantum mechanics. Otherwise, you may speculate about other theories, but the question is whether they might have a realization in some sense. And a priori, you may say, well, no, because they are, you know, they assume definite causal order, and quantum theory respects definite causal order. But of course, it's a little bit naive to jump to this conclusion because we have superpositions. So a priori, it's not implausible that there might be some way in which, say, the time at which different operations take place is in superposition. So this could be fully compatible with global unitary dynamics, and still there may be a sense in which Alice and Bob, these operations that we associate with Alice and Bob take place and they give rise to these outcomes. So, yeah. And in fact, there is the concrete example that was proposed prior to this work by Chiribella, D'Ariano, and Perinotti. This is the quantum switch. They conceived it as a hypothetical computer program which takes two black box operations, UA and UB. Here they are unitaries, but it's slightly more general in principle. And depending on the value of a control qubit, you either realize, let's say, if the qubit is zero, so you have a qubit, the control qubit, and a target system. And depending on the value of the control qubit, the logical value, you would either do first UB and then UA, or vice versa. So the transformation that you expect to be applied on your state is just given through this transformation. And in fact, they even suggested that, you know, if you consider not circuits in the sense of space-time diagrams, but if you think of circuits as really like physical circuits with wires, there is a way of obtaining the effect of this computer program by just by simply putting the wires in superposition. They did not go as far as to claim that this thing has an actual realization. They regarded this, as far as I understand, as sort of a strong suggestion that we need to maybe consider more general notions of quantum computing. In fact, they proved a theorem, a no-go theorem, which says that if you could do this operation, you can create a deterministic time travel, which is strongly suggests that maybe this is not possible, but I will have a comment on that. Nevertheless, you know, it seems that we can immediately think of simple things that seem to realize the program in some way, and the rest of my talk will be concerned with essentially discussions about whether such things can be really seen as realizing indefinite causal structures. Let me just comment on the more precise way of thinking about the quantum switch and slightly more general. Well, this is not the most general because, let me just say that in particular here, you may have other operations in between UA and UB, but I'll restrict specifically to the case where these are immediately one after the other. Viewed as a higher order operation or supermap, as Pavia introduced it, we may write this circuit. Essentially, what this operation does, it takes two operations that, I mean, we may define the transformation at the level of unitaries because every operation can be dilated to a unitary, with including auxiliary systems. So it is a higher order transformation that takes these two, this is the input to this mathematical transformation, and produces this channel that I have drawn here. It is a channel from these input systems to those output systems. And intuitively, the way people think about it is like this. Well, if you set the control qubit to be equal to zero, then in some way you may think that what's going on in this region in between is correspond to the system traveling, let's say, from this input to that out, etc., or vice versa. If it is one, you have this, and often we say, well, when we prepare this in a sort of superposition, somehow the two things are going on, and we sort of have something like indefinite causal structure in the middle, maybe. Um, yeah. Um, But this is actually very suggestive of concrete implementations. If this can be a particle that you can make go around along these paths. And in fact, people have done this. You can also view this as a, in the language of process matrices, you just need to close the wires everywhere. I mean, a process matrix is just an example of a higher order process where we don't leave open wires. So yes, if you introduce David and Charlie here, you may think of this as describing some kind of four-partite process matrix. Right, so this process matrix can be set, can be proven in, to be causally non-separable, which of course is a concept that we first need to define. I will not go much into the details of these definitions that we developed in detail in this paper here with Cristina Ghiarmazzi. But essentially, intuitively speaking, the observation is the following. I mean, this process matrix here is a pure process matrix. It's proportional to a rank one projector, so it cannot be written as a mixture of anything. At the same time, it allows signaling from Alice to Bob as well as from Bob to Alice to some extent. And these conditions, if you properly define them, they mean, they imply that this thing cannot be causally separable. So in other words, well, this causally separable means that in a very precise sense, which I don't want to now elaborate on, there is, we can think of there existing a classically definite causal order between the operations of Alice and Bob, or more generally for three or four parties, you need a more general concept which allows the possibility for dynamical causal relations, but all this is taken care of. And you may argue that yes, in that sense, it is not causally separable. It's not compatible with classical existence of definite causal order, but it is. This is a very device-dependent statement. It really, the whole statement depends on how we describe the process matrix. It's not like a causal inequality. In fact, it can be proven that these kinds of processes cannot violate causal inequalities. So they are non-causal in a somewhat weak sense in compared to the example I showed. Still, they are, in a way. All these discussions about the difference between causality and causal separability we have developed here, there is a whole zoo of classes of causally separable causal processes you may define. I'm just mentioning that this exists a theory for this, but I will not be concerned with the theory here. We'll just take it that the quantum switch, in some rigorous sense, can be said to be causally non-separable, and I'll be concerned with whether it can actually be realized, whether what people do in the lab can be said to be an instance of this higher-order transformation. So, yeah, there have been experiments, of course, just inspired by the pictures I showed earlier. You can make a photon go along different paths, and you can encode the target system in the polarization. So this is one instance. You can do this in many different ways, and actually what I will talk about is independent of the precise realization. It's really the argument goes at the level of circuits, so you can do these circuits of unitaries any way you like. Doesn't matter how it's done. The question I want to discuss is whether these are can be said to be actual realizations or are they just simulations. And the difference is, yes, we know by construction that they will produce the outcome of the higher order operation called quantum switch. So you can put whatever black boxes you want in the laboratories of Alice and Bob. Here they are not boxes in the sense of the circuit language, like space-time regions, but they are more like physical boxes that you put there and you say, well, this box is such that if a photon passes at a given time, it's going to do the operation UA, for example, on the polarization degrees of freedom. This you can verify. But of course, the photon is created in such a way that it goes in superposition. And now you may discuss whether these are really realizations or they're just simulations. And the simulation, just I want to, for my purposes, this question that I'm asking here, realization versus simulation, means the following. Simulation is something that would produce, it's a somewhat narrow definition that I take, but this is, I want to elaborate on the meaning that I put into this question. Simulation would be something that produces the outcome of the quantum switch. So the quantum switch is a transformation which takes the input operations that we say associated with Alice and Bob and produces a channel. So you may produce this channel in various ways. The fact that you go in the lab and you produce the channel does not necessarily mean that you have actually realized the higher order transformation. Now, the way I think would like to define realize here is that I would like to say it like that. The outcome of the operation would need to be produced by using exactly once the input operation of Alice and exactly once the input operation of Bob. And if you look into the precise definition of higher order maps as it is introduced in the quantum switch paper by Pavia and Valeron, there is a particular input Hilbert space and a particular output Hilbert space on which the input operations act. It is not specified what these Hilbert spaces ought to be, but it is important to realize that, yes, they come with this. There is a certain input and output on which the operation happens, and that gives rise to the outcome of the quantum switch. So from a temporal perspective, these experiments can be, of course, described using the language of unitary evolution in time. Roughly speaking, we may argue that we can reduce such an experiment to more or less a circuit of this kind. You don't want to... I discuss in the paper how precisely which Hilbert spaces we should restrict to, such as to see the experiment in this language. I mean, more generally, it's just... From the point of view of quantum field theory, of course, there is just some unitary evolution going on. These devices are always there throughout every time, so it's not even a discrete situation, but you may reduce to a subspace, such as to see this circuit, if you like. Or just take it for the purposes of this talk. This is not a comment on those specific experiments. This is a discussion about whether circuits of this kind can be thought to realize the higher order operation. So what we see here is basically you have controlled operations where this is the control qubit Q at the beginning of the experiment and Q prime is at the end and S is the target system in the usual way we describe the switch. Well, not the usual necessarily, but the quantum switch has this, the outcome of the quantum switch has a distinguishes the qubit from the target system. And here I have drawn for some unitaries that are for UA and UB that act on auxiliary systems in the laboratories of Alice and Bob. This is what the circuit would look like. Basically, these are controlled unitaries. So the black dot is a control on one. So somehow the controlled operation is triggered when the qubit is one. The white dot means it's triggered when it is zero. So here you see that here is the target system. Effectively, what's going on is that using imprecise classical language, if the qubit is zero, UA is going to take place here. Otherwise, UA is effectively absent. Or if it is the qubit is one, it's UB, or vice versa. And then everything goes to Charlie. I should also mention that this quantum switch, I mean, it has been proposed, it has been shown that this higher order operation allows certain things that you could not achieve using if the operations of Alice and Bob were a part of a circuit. So there are distinguishability tasks you can accomplish it and so forth. So it is of interest not only from a foundational point of view, but it seems to be a resource for information processing in some sense. But of course, whether this resource is useful in practice is another question. It's just at an abstract level, you may see it as permitting something that is not permitted otherwise. So here's what the circuit would look like. I will use a somewhat simplified version just because my generalization of this goes through this kind of construction, but it's really the same. I just assume that Bob's operation is localized in time, and then Alice may be applied earlier or later. It gives rise to the same transformation. And now, here I will just for simplicity, not to keep all these wires, I will use a somewhat wrong graphical notation. I will just drop in the ancillas, putting some just Alice, Bob Alice here, without being specific. I mean, one should emphasize that the controlled operation is not a well-defined concept. You can define controlled unitary, but we should understand that we are talking about unitaries here, acting on sufficiently large systems. So now this is basically the circuit that I want to discuss. And we said it already, when this is one, Alice happens first. If it is zero, it happens later. This is the effective kind of transformation, if you like. Of course, it is, I believe, wrong to be saying that Alice, to speak in this language. But it will become clear why, I think, now. So essentially, in each of these extreme cases, we may say that the operation of Alice takes place once on the target system. It's important that when you make this statement, somehow the control qubit is external to the statement. Somehow you're conditioning on it, so you're really making a statement about what's going on the target system. But nevertheless, let's say that we're happy with this statement because, as far as the target system is concerned, it is true that if you were to prepare this in the zero state, the operation of Alice happens once, and it happens here, and you can verify it through tomography. And even though, indeed, in fact, it happens at different places in the circuit for the two different classical cases, but never mind, let's say that it is okay. The problem is that the following, on what grounds can we claim that actually the correct operation happens once when the control qubit is prepared in some different state? So we have an operational meaning for the extreme classical cases. We can verify the statement. We know what it means. Just do standard tomography on the specific region. However, in the experiments, or when we want to obtain something interesting with this, we would like to prepare the control qubit in a superposition. So how can we claim, on what grounds can we say that the operation still happens exactly once? I think the heuristic argument is, because it's a superposition. I mean, one happens in one branch of the universe, the other happens in the other. Altogether, it happens just once. Somehow, the time is indefinite. But I think that, this can even be supported by adding a counter. Like, you can say, some generalized operation here, which is such that whenever the controlled operation is triggered, it's going to raise a flag, and at the end you can verify some kind of counter that precisely one was done. Now, the problem is that the counter is only verified to work as evidence, again, in the extreme cases. So, if you just use that argument without any further elaboration, this argument still suffers from a problem, because what you have done is just an extrapolation. You just propose that, we have these extreme cases where you may verify that the counter works correctly. You can say this is a valid evidence, this counter, because you can check if it is zero. You can verify that the counter works correctly, and you can verify that the operation indeed took place once. You can verify where it is because you can do tomography. And you can do the same in the other extreme case. However, you need to postulate that this is evidence in the intermediate cases.
Prepare any superposition, and your counter will say one.
Yes. And you define that the counter is a good evidence for what you want to say. Yes. And that is my point. That actually, it's fine. It's very reasonable. It's very compelling. Especially, I think, with intuitions coming from many worlds, it is very, very compelling. But I may say, fine, you choose to postulate this. It's tempting to postulate it. Essentially, that's what we do if we just say the counter told us what happened. But I think such a postulate is empty unless you say a little more. I mean, you want to support this with a theory which tells us precisely where the operation takes place. And not only that, but should also allow us to probe the operation. Just like we know how to probe and verify that the operation takes place in the extreme cases, you want to be able to verify that in the general situation where you don't fix the qubit to be zero or one. So, and that's what I want to now say, that it is possible to do. Now I want to say that we can identify Alice's operation in a precise sense, and it's actually also operational, that we can probe the operation. And it is this. So consider again the circuit. Now here, David, Bob, and Charlie's operations are clear. They're at definite time, so there's no controversy what it means that they take place. But somehow Alice's operation should be, if it really exists, some kind of part of this quantum comp. And I'm just rewriting the quantum comp so that the wires don't go around each other. It's this. This is a quantum comp. So it is an operation, actually. A quantum comp is the is a fragment of a circuit. It is, in fact, a quantum comp is defined as the operation implemented by the fragment of the circuit. So the quantum comp is an operation from the input systems, which are Q, A1, S, and B2, to the output systems, which are Q prime, A2, S prime, and B1. This is a valid operation. It is an instance of a valid quantum operation. In this case, it is unitary, but quantum comps are defined more generally. They are operations. They are just a restricted class of all operations we normally permit because of causality here. If this is in the future of this, obviously, this operation cannot allow signaling from this input to this output. If causality is respected, but it is a valid operation. And that operation, you can even test it by tomography. What you just plug another quantum comp here to test what this quantum comp is. Here is a sort of intuitive example. You may kind of pull down this wire to an identity channel back to the past. So in this way, all your, if you want to relate to your usual notion of preparation, transformations, and measurements, you can now do the joint preparation here at an earlier time. And similarly, you may extend sort of the output and do the measurement on the output of this operation. And so you can do tomography on this. Very trivial. Maybe you have objections because of the extension of wires, for instance. But it is at least a consistent way of defining what this means. Yeah, the unitary that this quantum comp, the unitary describing this quantum comp is actually the following transformation I have written is really like a controlled operation where, like, now this is a unitary transformation from the input Hilbert space of this fragment to the output Hilbert space of this fragment. And by composing the operations, you can verify that it is this. Essentially, here you have something like a controlled unitary, when it is the control qubit is zero, you're mapping from your unitary UA maps from B2, B2 A1. So A1 is always an input, because it's the auxiliary system in the local laboratory of Alice. So this is from A1, B2 to S prime A2. In other words, the operation happens here, or otherwise it happens earlier. It's simple. But the observation we can make is the following, that this operation can be written in the following form. It can be written as the unitary that you want on some with some input system A1 and A2, which are the input and output systems of Alice. Tensor, an identity transformation from some other complementary subsystems. And the subsystem A1 is, in fact, a non-trivial subsystem of the following. It's a subsystem of the of these input systems. It's a subsystem of Q, S, and B2. And that subsystem is, when I say non-trivial, I mean it is kind of delocalized among all those three. And it's given by the following algebra of operators. So let's take an operator O acting on the input system A1 within the global Hilbert space of Q, S, and B2. It looks like this. This is, so generally a subsystem, can be identified within a larger Hilbert space by essentially pointing to the sets of operators that are local on that subsystem. So that's why, it is defined by the operator algebra. And this is an operator algebra, you know, the operators of this form. They're isomorphic to O1, so this is what they are. And similarly, the output system of Alice can be, which is this A2 here, is again such a time delocalized subsystem. I call it time delocalized because it is a subsystem which, you know, is a subsystem of a tensor product of B2, S, and A1. And these are associated with different times. So in that sense, it is delocalized. And more precisely, what we can say is that it has some overlap with each of these subsystems in the following sense. I cannot localize it within these two, for instance. In that sense, it has a non-trivial overlap with B2. I cannot localize it in these two either. There is a non-trivial overlap with the control qubit. And this is also important because normally with this heuristic argument, we say, well, the operation happens on the target system at some indefinite time. But actually, if you do this more careful analysis, yeah, we can identify the operation, but the operation is not, it happens on a subsystem which even has a bit of overlap with the control qubit. So it's not only some subsystem of the two different times of the target system, but it has a little bit of spread over to the control qubit. Okay, so yeah, in summary, this supposed operation, we can identify it. It has these input and output systems that we have pointed out. And in principle, we can even test it by tomography in just the way I said we can do tomography of quantum comps. In the same way, you can plug, you can prepare a state in a subsystem of the input systems. And you can make a measurement on a subsystem of the output system, so you can just address that particular slot, if you like, in which the operation is supposed to happen to verify this. I mean, it's trivial by construction that it's going to work, but still, I think it is, in contrast to the other argument here, at least I can directly check the operation, even though it's not localized in time. So, basically the conclusion here is the following. There is a way of decomposing your experiment in parts, meaning subsystems, basically. You can choose what local parts to look at such that you can actually see the full experiment in this form. It's just that these A1 and A2 are these time delocalized subsystems. So if you choose this kind of partition of your experiment, you can see it to have the right form that we expect. It's just that these are time delocalized in this example. Now, just a comment on causal non-separability. Roughly what it means to say that this is a causally non-separable process means that this thing that is in the middle, this W operation that connects all these delocalized pieces or localized, it cannot be decomposed into a probabilistic mixture of circuits or some dynamical probabilistic mixture of circuits. So this is the sense in which it is, this is causally non-separable. And now naturally, we may ask whether this idea of time delocalized subsystems would actually point a way of finding a realization of any process matrix that is logically possible in this process matrix framework. It seems because whether you view the process matrix framework as derived based on the assumptions that I outlined, or you view it as a higher order transformation as Pavia introduced, I mean, this is very compelling, this kind of, especially in the higher order point of view. I think it is very strange that these mathematically allowed higher order transformations would not have a realization, but it could be. It could be that in this particular universe, which seems to obey causality, or at least in these regimes where we have verified that, maybe this is not possible, but there is a chance, I think, that the concept of time delocalized subsystem offers us a framework within which to actually rigorously ask this question. Because before that, I wouldn't know how to even possibly try to answer that question, unless being suddenly very smart and coming up with the solution. But here, at least now, we may ask, are there time delocalized subsystems between which we can imagine we could do operations without post-selection? This is very important because all this can be done with post-selection. So the question really is, what can we do without post-selection? And so basically, in this paper, I have shown that there is a class of processes which is a priori larger than the quantum switch, but in fact, we don't know whether it is larger. For a class of processes, we can prove realizability in that sense. There are time delocalized subsystems with respect to which we can see the process taking place. First I will show this for unitarily extensible processes. These were introduced by Araújo and collaborators. These are process matrices which admit realization in the following sense. Imagine a bipartite one. Here my proof only goes for bipartite process matrices. Imagine a bipartite process matrix which could be obtained from a larger four-partite process matrix in the following way. This is a unitary process now. It's a unitary transformation or unitary channel from the input wires to all the output wires. And here, by plugging a suitable state and then tracing out, we will obtain this. It turns out, actually, it's very important. Not every process matrix admits, this is the one of the most remarkable results of this paper, is that not every process matrix admits this. I mean, of course, this is a channel from the inputs of the parties to the, from the outputs of the parties to the inputs, and so every channel, of course, admits a unitary extension. However, if you do this extension, this will not be a valid four-partite process matrix in general. So not all process matrices admit, but there is a class that we can define. These are unitarily extendable processes, and for those we can prove, and maybe I'll guide you very quickly through the proof, so you can see this is kind of the more non-trivial part of the paper, because the other was just an observation. Here now we can have a kind of general proof. Well, basically, first of all, we may observe, just as before, that if we plug the operation of Alice in the slot of Alice, this is a higher order operation on the input of Bob. And it's been proven by Kiribello, Dariano, and Perinotti that every higher order operation or super map on a single operation, which is Bob's operation in this case, has a realization as a circuit like this, as a quantum comb. So this suggests that, at least in principle, we can search for implementations of the one of the kind I was just describing for the quantum switch. Maybe there is a way that, from a global temporal perspective, we will see two unitaries or channels going on here, but there will be a way of interpreting them again as containing the correct operation of Alice once on some time delocalized slot. It suggests a realization in time. So now, how can we find whether there are such subsystems? It's actually the process matrix itself kind of allows us to define those subsystems. So remember, we assume that the process can be unitarily extended in this way. So this is a valid process now. Now what we could do is put a swap operation here such that we would essentially pull down these wires and then again use the exact same reasoning. We notice that since this is now an operation on Alice's side, a higher order operation on Alice's side, it will have a realization as a circuit fragment, as a quantum comb. Moreover, they have proven in their paper, they have a constructive proof, Pavia, that actually the constructive proof is based on the minimal Steinspring dilation. So for a unitary channel, this can be seen. It's possible to take them to be unitary, actually. So so there exist these two unitaries, and then you can, by looking at this circuit, you see that the unitaries actually tell you how to define the subsystems. What we can notice here is that A2, which will be the output of Alice, through this unitary gets mapped onto a subsystem of these two. There is a map that's unitary, isomorphically maps the subsystem A2 onto some subsystem here. And similarly, A1 through the reverse unitary would be mapped somewhere here. And let's call the map A tilde 2 and A1 tilde. These were abstract maps, but these are some abstract subsystems. Now we can define them. We can identify the physical, the input of Alice. I have forgotten to change here superscript. This is 1 and 2. It was E for input and O for output, but this is 1 and 2. Basically, we can say that Alice's input is this subsystem, the A1 tilde subsystem, and the A2 tilde subsystem. And by construction, the fact that UA happens on these subsystems will be obeyed. In fact, one proves that the unitary implemented by this quantum comb that you will do around Bob would decompose exactly in the right way. There will be the unitary of Alice going on the subsystems that I identified. And it will be like tensor with identity transformation on the rest. So we have a construction for this case. And in fact, even a slightly more general class of processes, we can have a similar proof or basically the following class. We can consider processes that admit extension to an isometry, but with an extra condition. Everything admits extension to an isometry. That is trivially true, but what I'm assuming here is non-trivial is that there exists an isometry, an isometric four-partite process such that this subsystem will be, so there will be a subsystem of D2, P2, so a subsystem of these guys that will get mapped onto A1 through this isometry. This is not in general possible. For instance, if this was a one-dimensional subsystem, it may be impossible. I mean, it is generally this not the case, but this is the assumption. And so you assume that whether with respect to Alice or with respect to Bob, you have the fact that the input of one of the guys, in this case A1, comes from a subsystem of this. It may not be the case. But if you have this, just the analogous proof to what I just said goes through. And for this class of processes, we can prove it. So naturally, we may ask, how big is this class? It is at least as big as the unitary class. As defined, it's even strictly larger. But the problem is that it may be that anything I can write in this form also admits a unitary extension. So in practice, although by definition this class is strictly larger, it may not be physically larger, so to say. It may admit a unitary realization. So maybe I fall back in the previous class. In fact, we don't even know whether the unitarily extensible processes must all have realizations with these controlled operations, like the quantum switch. It's not clear. But many things are possible. A priori, it could be that even every process matrix might have such a realization. These are open questions, so we don't know. And so I would like to just in the last minutes just mention potential doubts, objections about this argument. And the first one that I have encountered several times is that there are two or even more and infinitely many, because if you consider the vacuum and so where you put your optical devices, there are infinitely many or more than one, for sure, uses of the controlled operation or some extended operation acting on the larger Hilbert space that includes the vacuum. So my answer to this objection is that actually, yes, this is correct, of course. This is what is going on from a temporal perspective. However, the quantum switch, these operations, they are not the input to the higher order operation called quantum switch. So the quantum switch is defined with as an abstract transformation from two input boxes to another channel, where these input boxes, they have input and output systems of specific dimension. And what I have shown is that such subsystems do exist, and precisely one use of the operation happens there in this realization of the switch. So yes, there are other, I mean, you may say that there is another more powerful resource being used in the realization of the switch. This is true. However, we use it in an extremely constrained way, such that, I mean, if you're given these controlled operations, you can do many things. If you use them many times, you can do many times the input operations, you can do whatever you like. The point is we do not do whatever we like. I mean, the point is that we use them in a very constrained fashion, such as to realize precisely the allowed operation in the right slot once. So, yes, it has this realization, it has this temporal description, but it does not mean that we use multiple times the resource. The input to the quantum switch is this operation with some specific input and output systems, and I pointed which they are, and I think I'm right to say that they happen once there. And then there is another thing I mentioned, there is this no-go theorem that says that if you could, so they proved in their paper that if you could realize the switch by plugging the operations in a circuit, or rather in some fragment, which is kind of causality-preserving fragment, of a circuit, then you could actually realize deterministic time travel, but should be noted that actually this theorem assumes that you can plug Alice and Bob in such a way that one is in the past of the other, because you need to wire them, the auxiliary systems, to obtain this. But it is in principle possible that you may have realization where Alice and Bob operations occupy space-like separated regions of your circuit part, in which case you could not wire them. And this is what is happening actually here. We cannot wire them. But so this is this kind of realization. Nevertheless, there is still a cyclic structure in this realization. It's just not exactly the deterministic time travel that they talked about. But there is still this cyclic structure. Although I would not say that this means a time-like loop in the lab. This is just a loop of some kind. And so, but to summarize, we can introduce this concept of time delocalized subsystems and operations, which can be very easily tested, just like normal. They're normal operations. We're just talking about subsystems which are associated with different inputs at different space-time locations. And with respect to those, we can see that some non-causally non-separable processes have an actual implementation without without post-selection. So the questions are, what more can we prove? Which processes are possible? Which higher order processes are possible? Can this perspective inform useful applications? I think this is interesting because, I mentioned people have proven theorems that the quantum switch can be used for certain things that you cannot achieve with definite causal structure. On the other hand, if you do it this way, people may question whether this is really useful because still I need, for example, if I wanted to save on time complexity in some way, in some sense, I still need as much time as I would need to use twice the operation, for example. So, but I think that this kind of perspective might suggest useful implementations. And another question that I want to connect also to the talk of Philip about quantum reference frames. And here I should also mention another related work by the other Philip, Alard Guérin. They have some idea about general notion of quantum reference frames. I think that now it's natural to ask whether there might be, we can link this subsystem perspective to idea of time delocalized quantum, quantum reference frames for time and space. In particular, there is a proposal for a realization of the switch with at the interface of GR and quantum mechanics. And I think that this subsystem perspective may tell us something about the mathematical apparatus that might be appropriate to actually reason about this hypothetical possibility. Thank you.
It's
a very good question.
These time delocalized subsystems, you can run the same proof as you did in the bipartite case, mm-hmm. and sort of find them, but then still doesn't mean that there's a realization.
Yes, exactly. This is a very good question, actually. So, first one should give a little background that actually there exist tripartite processes which admit a unitary extension and they violate causal inequalities. And in fact, one of the most extreme examples is the kind of classical process by Baumeller, Fakes, and Wolf. They admit unitary extensions, and one may wonder whether we can extend this proof to argue that actually these things have realizations on time delocalized subsystems. And actually, the reason, one naive thing one might do is to just map. You just consider the unitary channel given by the quantum con and can ask how does a given subsystem map onto some other subsystems. However, in general, through this mapping, you may map the output of Alice onto the input of Bob and Charlie and something else. But you don't know where Bob and Charlie, how to implement Bob and Charlie in the lab. Here, we can avoid this problem because we can always choose Bob to be at a fixed time. And once I know what Bob is, then through this mapping, I'm mapping the abstract subsystems of Alice onto concrete time-localized subsystems. I'm mapping it onto a delocalized subsystem, but of Hilbert space, which is associated with a definite time. Whereas in the tripartite case, I don't know how to do that. I know how to map Alice onto Bob, Charlie, and environmental other systems, but I wouldn't know how to realize Bob and Charlie. And there are some ideas I have that I think might work or might not, like with nested quantum comps somehow, but some theorems are missing. So I think it's a very natural question about to explore.
I have a remark on the way in which you described the proof that we gave of the impossibility of the switch, because you said we assume that they are time ordered, but what you can prove is that actually this is not restrictive. So also the case in which they are time-like, space-like separated is contained in this structure that we assumed at the beginning. So the only thing that so the theorem assumes that if you can do the switch with a circuit, this means that you can allow the connection of ancillary systems of possible boxes to be plugged in the input as you want.
Yeah, that's what I meant. And that's what I meant by saying that they are, yeah, that you can connect the ancillaries. But that is not necessarily, I mean, you may now say, okay, what if I don't demand that? And then you can't prove your theorem.
Yes,
and
so
actually, here you couldn't do that because they really are space-like separate somehow from the global point of view. So in practice, I wouldn't know how to connect.
So this is not a circuit. It's something more constrained.
Well, I would say that this, like, so let's say this is Alice. And here is Bob. This is an example of a circuit where, however, I have implicitly used the blackboard as a sort of background with respect to which now I understand that Bob is in the past, so if I could in principle do this. Now, consider some physical implementation where these are now space-like separated regions. Imagine just a standard circuit, a preparation, measurement here, or something like that. This is a circuit still, but I could not. If realized in that form, I could not wire this guy to this guy. So in that sense, of course, there is no contradiction with your theorem. That's all I'm saying is that, yes, we don't obey some of the assumptions of the theorem. We could not wire here Alice and Bob.
I don't agree with your interpretation of the left diagram, because in that case, you can take A and B along the wires until one gets in the future of the other one, and then you can do the connection.
In this specific realization, I told you where they happen, so you cannot move them. I mean, you are assuming that you can actually move them around and do stuff.
Yeah,
yes, this you cannot do here. Yes, they just happen where they happen.
That's what I said. It's more constrained than a normal circuit, because in a normal circuit, you can move boxes along wires as long as they don't encounter other boxes.
Sure, if I make this... Well, it depends how you interpret wires. I would say this is a circuit, and I don't think I can move anything. It depends on the point of view. I think if you... well, what I've shown is that this is... I mean, I wouldn't call it a circuit, of course, but you would also not call exactly a circuit thing which has a loop, a deterministic kind of channel back in time. It's not a proper circuit. It's a cyclic circuit that you prove, right? Here we also have a cyclic situation, in a way, but you wouldn't have. So yes, you cannot move them. You cannot move them.
I hate to interrupt this discussion. I think we're getting into interesting territory here. But we are in the coffee break time. We started 5 minutes late, so it's okay to go a little bit later. Let's meet back here at 11:30 for the latest talk on counterfactual communication protocols.